We're delighted to have David Tweed here to speak to us this morning. A couple of years ago at the conference, he took that opportunity to formally send his resignation email into the church while we were all here. And that was quite, it was a great event. And I know that had been a hard decision for him for a while to do it formally. So it was really a fun thing to be a part of that. David, some of you know, has his own blog, and I love reading his stuff because it's insightful and some usually very well footnoted and links for the stuff that he's talking about, and I always appreciate that. One little note of interest, shortly after I put out the initial announcement who our speakers were going to be, his ex-wife was invited to be on a panel at the Fair Mormon Conference. And the subject was to discuss was about when one of the family members leave and what it is like to deal with that as a still-believing Mormon. And I was able to see a video of that particular panel. And honestly, I thought most of the people handled it fairly well. I mean, it could have been a lot worse, but they all made it very clear, including his wife, that in spite of how many times their spouses or family member had tried to give them the information that might, you know, pry open their thinking a little bit, that it just didn't work. That was the basic message, that the faithful don't let those things, you know, influence them. So I'm sure it wasn't very pleasant to have your former wife and for the rest of them people on the panel whose spouses had left to have it be that public. But since David had gone public, I'm sure his ex decided that she could be public too, and that's their right. David has written and been involved in some of the responses that have been written on Mormon Think to the essays that the church is putting out. And that's kind of a collective exercise of the people that are involved with Mormon Think. And I think they've done a fabulous job of refuting in a very, you know, non-confrontational way, but full of a lot of information, kind of refuting the essays, each one as they come out. I'd like to just immediately now turn the time over to David. I've told him not to shorten his presentation. We'll make up the time as we go along. And for your information and delight, here is David Tweed.
Thank you, everyone. I'll just load this up. And I will. I've thought about having surgery to fix that problem, but it's very expensive. Is that okay? Oh, I don't want to talk right into it. So. Okay. I'm not a mic swallower. Okay, let's just get right into it. Thank you, Sue, for that introduction. I am not going to talk about family in my talk. I know that has happened. I'm not going to discuss that further myself, but I appreciate the context. I want to discuss a variety of things. It's going to be kind of a potpourri, but I will try to tie it all together. But right away, what I want to bring up here is to question an assumption that all of us might have here, or many of us have, and I'm very serious about this. This is not a joke. We think the LDS Church is a lie. We think Joseph Smith was a scammer. But I'm going to tell you that his contributions are probably invaluable to human history and human progress, and I'll explain. Okay. Social anthropologists have hypothesized that one way religion started was they find a religious center of attention in cave dwellings and cave drawings. And the hypothesis goes that leaders or people who were important to the tribe received hallucinations, visions, and other inspiration within the cave, much like a sensory deprivation chamber, perhaps using external substances and so forth and so on. And as they did so, the idea of a mystical, invisible being giving information may have arisen from that kind of experience. And the sacredness of that was displayed on the cave walls. But over time, even as people began to accept this, the hypothesis goes that eventually, as the leaders became either corrupt or lazy or took the offerings that were placed for the invisible being and enriched themselves, the people investigated the cave and found nothing there. So the next stage was to move it above ground into a guarded cave or a pyramid or a shaft or a house of worship. And being guarded, it maintained the leader's ability to enrich themselves and provide their almost infallibility to the people as they spent enormous labor, enormous riches to build their palaces. And however, as we know from history, those corrupt systems were also eventually overthrown in part by the insiders, the guards, the servants, and others who saw what was really going on. So God was moved a little further away to the mountain. The mountain in the Old Testament of the Lord is a very important element of its teaching. The guru on the mountain in Hinduism and the idea that only those who were special would go up to the mountain to see God. But it was still close to the people. And in the New Testament times, we see a shift, or I should say in the Greek civilization, we see a shift to something called heaven and something called hell, or Hades. And this removed God from the people further and put him in a place that they couldn't reach. This created the illusion of those who were in communication with God, and whatever means they claimed they were having communication with God created the illusion that they were in charge. However, science marching forward brings Galileo and its telescope, and they peer into the heavens, and what do they see? Nothing from God. So, what has religion done since? It has moved God beyond space and time, outside of the universe. The definitions of God now define him as greater and bigger, and the creator of the universe and bigger than the universe. As the universe, or the size of our reality expanded to include beyond the solar system, the galaxy, and then the universe, God kept getting moved further and further outside. What this did was this created a separation of man from God. It created an indiscernible, infallible, and impersonal God. So what did Joseph Smith contribute here? Well, he brought God back to the ground. The white-bearded man was now flesh and bone. He was now personable. And he, Joseph Smith, produced at least stories, if not actual, made-up evidence of plates and papyri and other things that made his story seem more believable. But this caught on, this was popular of the time because God was so impersonable that he brought a personable God to people. But what he did is he made testable claims. In this sweet period between the printing press and the internet, where there's documentation, but not so much that it discloses all of the details of how he created the scam, allowed the church to grow in this vacuum while it also was documented. And then when the internet came, and other people were documented before the internet, of course, but as the internet came and the documentation exploded and became available to all, we can now see this model of how a scam is produced. It's difficult to find that model on earlier religions. This provides us a peek into how religions begin and grow in a kind of an environment of easy delusion before the era, I believe, that we're in the middle of or starting now of fixing or correcting those. So I want to start there with the idea that the Mormon movement could be important to history in that it gives us a reliable model of how religious scams arise and helps us to understand how the rest might have as well. Now, my motivation for my talk comes from my experience, which much of which is pretty poor because I'm not all that smart, and I had had plenty of bad judgment in my life, but out of bad judgment comes experience, and that's how we learn. I want to discuss the essays Sue mentioned. I want to discuss their effect on the members. Were they inoculating the members? Did they inform the members? What did they do? And I want to discuss by the end also how ex-Mormons have brought information to the rest of the world, and if it is effective or if it is not effective, and what resources we might use to do better. Now, I want to give a little history about myself, because I've been asked to do that. Hopefully, history will be on our side, because we'll win. The church will eventually disintegrate or dissolve, and the truth will prevail. So my history is tied with Mormon Think. Mormon Think started in early 2005 by a group of people, including one you know by Bill Johnson, came last year and gave a Friday night testimony. Diane Orman was there at the beginning as an editor, and Ken Clark early on as well. They were active members who were looking into the truth, trying to figure out where they really stood with all of this data, and decided to create a website so that all of the information that was out there and disparate in different books and different places could be approachable and accessible by people at large. Of course, things were in forums already, but they were kind of mishmash and disorganized. I'm not saying that Mormon Think is absolutely organized the best that it could be, but it has improved. There were a lot of active members contributing, many of them have ended up leaving their church. Some of them have not yet to this date left the church, but they're not satisfied with the way the church puts out the information, even the essays. So in early 2012, Salt Lake City contacted his stake president and told them that he needed to have a little sit down with him about Mormon Think. Well, how did they find out? Because he keeps his name, his real name, and his identity fairly secret. Well, there was cyber sleuthing going on, according to the stake president, that uncovered him through his online activity, what his real identity was. Salt Lake then sent that identity down, and his stake president was directed to monitor his activity at Mormon Think and to try to get him to stop it. And also to find out maybe who the other members and who else was working it. Mormon Think founder asked his stake president to point out what's incorrect. If you can show me what's incorrect, I'll change it. The stake president refused to have that discussion. He just would not go there. He said, you don't tell me what to do, basically. I tell you what to do. They called the disciplinary court on him. He had family concerns, so he did not make that public. He did resign very quietly. It is not well known, even in his own stake and ward, that he's resigned. And they still visit and work with some of the members in the area, and they want to keep it that way. So his identity is still remains a secret. At that point, I had a sit down with Bill. I was very angry, and I said, I do not like what the church did in sleuthing you out, and I think that this calls for a kind of an action against them. So I took over the reins as managing editor, and I targeted my articles with my first name and created purposefully, to some extent, some controversy. Wrote about Romney, wrote about his politics in view of his temple covenants, wrote about whether Christians were, or Mormons are Christians, and then we posted that as a kind of more of a political piece on Mormon Think. I also kept my blog. I attended church again after a long period of not attending, and kept a record of my attendance and tried to make it somewhat literary and fun to read. In about a month, they got a hold of my name. Scott Gordon, the president of FAIR, told the New York Times and the Salt Lake Tribune that he took my name and sent it to his friends at the church offices building. And then I was at church. I had never met my stake president. I'd never met my bishop. I'd met the high priest group leader. I'd met a few people, but I did not know the leadership of the stake or the ward. And I was sitting at the end of sacrament meeting. The stake executive secretary comes over to me and says, are you Brother Tweed? And I said, yes. And he says, the stake president wants to talk to you. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, good. So I pulled out my cell phone. Let me just silence then. I put a little recording app on. And I went into the 45 minutes of interrogation, and I'm going to play this. But when I asked them how they found out who I was, one of the state counselors says, maybe we were inspired by the Lord to find you. I didn't know what had happened exactly by that point, but I found out later what had happened. I'm going to play you this clip, and it's transcribed so you can read along. By the way, the photos that you see in my briefing are my artwork. I've been working for over a decade in modifying digital cameras to create what's called color infrared photography, and I did this for work back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and turned it into an art form in early 2000s, and am a represented artist in that regard. But anyway.
We're suggesting to you that we will hold a disciplinary council and ask you to come and explain your views.
Okay.
And then we'll go from there.
So you're saying you're going to have a council against me now?
That's correct.
Already?
Correct. We go under...
So what would I have to do to avoid that?
In terms of not having a council?
Yeah.
No, there's nothing.
Really? It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. Council, hopefully, is an opportunity for you to express the views that you are propagating in our midst here.
I didn't do any of that here. I did it offsite.
You came here and was very derogatory, in my opinion, what you wrote. So during this disciplinary council, which we have the letter, which will be out in 2 weeks, we will give you the opportunity.
In 2 weeks?
2 weeks. This is not a witch hunt, but we feel an obligation to protect the members of the church from antichrist or apostates contrary to the doctrines of the church. Bishop?
Yeah, that I feel that you've been somewhat disingenuous is based on your own comments in the blog about I don't want to be found out, I don't want anyone to know what's happening. So yeah, you're coming here being true, but yeah, you're showing a...
Well, because I did fear that I would get reprisal if somebody knew that I was the managing editor at MormonThink.com.
But if it was such an honorable thing and a good thing, and you didn't feel in your heart that it was a problem, then...
I don't feel it is in my heart, but I know that others do. So that's the concern.
So you knew that it was something...
Sure.
Probably the church would not...
Sure.
Right, you didn't...
Sure.
Okay.
Obviously, I know that because the church has a system in place by which they say, do not look at these materials. They believe that members should be very careful what they study and where they go and things like that.
So all that.
And there's a reason for that, I believe. But anyway, we can get into that.
Okay.
So I do think that, yes, the reason why I did not want my name out there was because I feared that something like this would probably happen, even though that... In my heart, I do believe that I am championing ultimately truth as managing editor of MormonThink.com. That's what I believe I'm doing. I truly believe that.
With the other individuals that you work with on that whole MormonThink.com,
I'm not going to talk about it.
Why would people be so secretive if he's putting it out there?
Because of church disciplinary courts.
I'm saying it just doesn't make sense to me. It's almost, I've got a secret, I'm going to hide it. Who's putting this? You see what I'm saying? It just doesn't make sense. When you say you're for truth, but you're not wondering who's behind the truth.
There's a statement.
It's like putting something out there, but not putting the person who put it out there.
That's true. That's true. Do you remember the Federalist Papers that were written? A lot of those were written anonymously, but the truth behind them is no less legitimate for that reason. Likewise, there's a saying that if you want to know who controls you, think of who you fear. I believe that a lot of people fear the Mormon Church.
When, thank you. This went on for 45 minutes, and they asked me several times about the other people working at Mormon Think, and I then reiterated the point about remaining hidden. I said, look, Joseph Smith wrote the Doctrine and Covenants in code names. And they said, oh, but he feared for his life. His life was endangered. Your life's not in danger. And he said, there's no Danites coming after you. And I looked at him and I thought, not physically. And I said, but you can lose more than your physical life. You can also lose your social life, your family life, your financial well-being, especially along the Wasatch Front. These are serious effects and changes on people, and they're not well received by neighbors and family oftentimes, and it can ruin your life. And I know that you don't understand this, but I'm telling you that it's just as devastating. Anyway, so they would not change. We decided to take this to the media. I think a lot of you know the story, but what you don't know is that when I actually released some of the statements to the press initially before they went off to the Daily Beast, Newsweek, and the New York Times, I was releasing these press releases, and my son Josh, and this is the only family member I'm going to talk about in my talk, my son Josh was with me. He was living with me in Florida at the time, and we went over to, he as my designated driver, still not 21, went with me and my friends to go have a beer at the World of Beer, and I released these on their Wi-Fi over there while I was having a beer. So take that, church. So the news got around. They did make it about the Romney criticism because I wrote those articles. And the leaders of the church, the stake president, did not say the name Romney to me, but he did say that he once mentioned it. He said, look, this is not political. I'm not a political man. I don't know why he even said that, because I didn't say anything about politics, but he brought it up. He was being very careful. I don't know why. The court was postponed indefinitely. I got sick and tired of dealing with it, so I decided to take the matters in my own hands and resigned, as Sue said, at the Friday night open mic 2012 here with their Wi-Fi. I sent it right there on the spot, and I did get my letter back. An interesting side note, I re-resigned about 6, maybe 8 months later, and wondering what they would say if I resent my resignation in. I sent a nice courteous one this time. And they sent back saying, our records show that you already resigned and that you're not a member. And I had asked them to take my names off of their records, but they don't take your names off of their records. We then did a study and analysis on the numbers of the reported membership and determined that, and I think other people have corroborated this, that they do count resigned members in their counting. Pretty sure. We don't have the hard evidence, but the numbers suggest it very strongly. If they don't, then they're playing really fast and loose with some other numbers we can't make heads or tails of. If you're interested in that, I have a whole blog that goes down that. Here in the audience, I have Maria Mastronardi, who is a professor at Northwestern and a non-Mormon. She has been very helpful to Mormon Think as a publicity expert in helping us to release statements. It was before she got on board, after I was already making my own horrible public releases up, and she improved many times what we were doing. And she worked with us on how to handle the fraud case that Tom Phillips built. Not all of the editorial board at Mormon Think was in agreement the way he handled that, but we tried to support him as managing editor. He got busy enough, he then resigned as managing editor in, I think it was March or April, and Scott Carls is now the managing editor, and he does a wonderful job. He keeps up the site, he actually adds content, and the other editors are very pleased with him, and I'm very pleased with his work too. I continue working as an editor emeritus. I still work with the founder and the board in helping to make decisions. I do provide content, and then I also keep the Mormon Disclosures blog, which is indirectly affiliated with Mormon Think. I provide a little bit more fiery approach to some of the topics. One of the things that I've raised on my Mormon Disclosures blog that will be of interest to you, and I think most of you already probably know this, is the Mission President's Handbook. By the way, since going after founder and me, Scott Carls, who his full name is there, and Tom Phillips, who they really well know, they have never filed a disciplinary court against any of them. And we believe it's because they got their eye blackened by our little press stunt. And I don't think they're going to go after any more editors. But if they want to, bring it on. Okay. Mission President's Handbook. This is kind of a focus of my blog is disclosures of documents that have not been out there before, particularly about wealth of the leaders of the church or their handling of finances. They're far and few, and they're hard to come by. So it's a short blog. Actually, it's about 80,000 words now. Pele missionary. in late December 2012, got a hold of the what we believed was the Mission President's Handbook. It disclosed several very interesting things I posted on the blog, wondering if it was really legit. Well, we put it up on archive.org, and within 2 days, archive.org got a letter from Bernie S. Broadbent, the Chief Intellectual Property Officer for the LDS Church, and I understand we have a Helena Broadbent in the audience. She's in the very back, who may be related to him. But anyway, he talked about a notice of infringement. He talked about, under penalty of perjury, I declare this is the property of the LDS Church. Guess what? We found out that the handbook is legitimate. Thank you, LDS lawyers. That's just what we wanted. We really wanted that information. We're glad they like to hide things, but when they come out, they then declare them as real and legitimate and tell us to give it right back to them. Huh, it's out there in the world. It's not coming back. Okay, let's see. Excuse me for a minute here. So, what does the Mission President's Handbook talk about? Well, the most interesting stuff are in the appendix. It talks about the finances of the Mission President. And I'm not going to go over a whole lot here, just this part. It says, do not share information on the funds you receive with anyone. Don't talk to your accountants or other people on the tax matter. Don't ever represent yourself as being paid by the church. Don't put any of that money into a separate account that is in your name that will produce interest and then gather the attention of IRS agents. We must control the account. Do not discuss this. Keep this strictly confidential. Don't bring it up with your missionaries, with other mission presidents, friends, or families. Pretty much it's just the church, the mission president, and his wife know what they're receiving, and they keep it secret. Why would they want to do that? Why would they need to keep it secret from other mission presidents and others? Because it must vary how much each mission president receives, and they don't want jealousy, and they don't want word out that these guys are paid so much. How much are they paid? There's a lot of secrecy, by the way, for a position that's about proclaiming. Well, what do they receive with this so-called stipend or the so-called living expense? I'm just going to run down the list and read it here. I don't know if everybody in the back can read the small print, so I'm going to read it for you. While you are serving as a mission president, church will reimburse the necessary living expenses for you, your wife, and your dependent children. The necessary living expenses include rent or lease or house payment, food, clothing, dry cleaning, household supplies, family activities, personal long-distance calls to family, modest gifts, except, for example, Christmas, birthdays, or anniversaries. How many of you get your gifts paid for by your work? Utilities, telephone, internet connection. How many of you get your internet connection paid for by your employer? Well, some of you might. Gardening, employed gardener. We don't have one for the church. The members must keep the grounds of the church up. But the mission presidents get the gardener, at least as of 2006. A part-time housekeeper, the clean, the part-time cook. Repair or replacement of household items. You break it, they pay it. Automobiles for mission president, for the wife, and for the children as needed. How nice. My kids could use a car. Automobile fuel, auto insurance, registration, taxes. Do you know how much it costs to insure a male child who's under 25? Oh, gosh. I'm sure Josh knows himself because he's doing it for himself now. He's going to throw some tomatoes at me. Medical expenses, dental, eye care, medically necessary, orthodontia, round-trip fare for each child under the age of 26 to visit the parents' mission, elementary, secondary school, expenses for tuition at private schools, undergraduate tuition at an accredited college, university, didn't say at the BYU, is any accredited college, and financial support for the children serving their mission. Their missions are paid for, everybody else is doing it themselves. Total package, at least 80,000, upwards of 200, maybe even more, we don't know for sure, but it's high. These are mission presidents, they serve 3 years, they're not general authorities, and this is what they're receiving. Now, Everybody asks me, where do I sign up? I say, I resign too young. In the United States, the tax laws are not so clear about all of these expenses being reported as income or not. It's very fuzzy. On the Senate Finance Committee, the ranking member, minority member is Senate Orrin Hatch, as you know. The Senate Majority Leader is Harry Reid, a Mormon. And there are several others who are in different committees which have worked on the charitable laws for Congress, including Orrin Hatch at one time and now others, who are very favorable to maintaining this level of tax exemption and write-offs for the churches out there, including the LDS Church. But the UK is not so liberal. They do have rules, and the Her Majesty Revenue Code tax document SA02 for ministers does say that their income, anything, any fees, gifts, or grants they receive can be considered pay, especially if the cash equivalent includes the benefit of housing, cars, medical insurance, college fees, cook, family travel, etc. These things are taxable, the things they just listed. They are absolutely taxable under UK law. So this was raised to the UK government in early 2013. Tom Phillips, who was the UK LDS financial controller when he was an active member decades ago, had brought this up with the LDS church leaders, and he said that the First Presidency and the presiding bishopric told him that they decided to continue not reporting and pay fines when necessary. Well, so much for sustaining and honoring the laws of the land. In any event, this is a blatant tax evasion, and it's been reported the UK is looking into it. And what may happen is they may pay a fine, but there won't be any imprisonment or any jail time. Okay. So this financial secrecy is pretty interesting. The idea here that they tell the mission presidents, do not share information, it's kept strictly confidential, don't discuss with anyone. The LDS Church is very big on non-disclosure agreements with their employees. And this is confirmed by many employees who have talked about the many tiers of non-disclosure agreements, although they're not allowed to show you the non-disclosure agreement because the non-disclosure agreement says they can't show you the non-disclosure agreement. In any event, they have been very clear, though, that they exist. I have talked to many church employees that have told me, yes, they exist, and I've signed them. And I have been told about different levels of them, depending upon your position. Joseph Smith, Mr. Money Digger, was more open about these kinds of things, though. Here he says in Doctrine and Covenants, it's a revelation from God. Remember, this is a revelation. There shall not any part be used or taken out of the treasury, only by the voice and common consent of the United Order, of the Order of the People. However, despite the fact that there was an early incorporation of the church by Joe Smith and a different incorporation by Brigham Young and then a disincorporation by the government under the polygamy era and then a reincorporation under a kind of a split level of companies for a time, and then 1923, as they were losing property to polygamous splinter groups, Heber J. Grant then incorporated the entire thing under one sole corporation that he had sole control over. And in the article is this: this corporation shall have power without any authority or authorization from the members of said church or religious society to grant, sell, convey, rent, mortgage, exchange, or otherwise dispose of any part or all of such property. This is a complete violation of their own revelation, what he did here. I was able to secure a copy of the original Articles of Incorporation and several of the amendments, including ones that happened just this year. And they're on my website, on my blog. I have the PDFs. If anybody wants them, I'll give them. It took me a while to dig in and find those and then order them, and I bought them. So just contact me. But they're basically their representations already on the blog, so you can see them all there. Pretty much anything of interest anyway. The fifth article, which was done by Harold B. Lee, talks about the dissolution of the LDS Church. And he says that when the church dissolves, the rest of the income after the debts are paid can be handed over to a charity, to a nonprofit organization like a charity that's educational or religious and or scientific purposes. Well, that's broad. And scientific purposes can be very, very lucrative. I work in science. I'm a scientist, and I work in developing technology. I file patents, and I can tell you that IP is a lot of money. A lot of portfolios are being sold around, from Google to Motorola to all kinds, and going into the tens, if not almost $100 billion kind of portfolio ranges. They're very, very expensive. And, you know, they have a very big intellectual properties arm called Intellectual Reserve Incorporated. And every one of you who is still a member, or any of you who were a member, you were owned as a piece of property on Intellectual Reserve Incorporated. Your name, that's your entire membership, was construed or consisted of your name on a list owned by Intellectual Reserve Incorporated. And that's how they associated you as a member of the church. Otherwise, you had no record of being a member. Now, that list was also shared with other systems, the membership information system and so forth and so on. I'm going to discuss a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, what's interesting down here at the bottom is this last one, 2014 July, President Monson allocated and authorized three other people to exercise his authority as sole corporate executive, as the corporate soul, and Robert Cantwell, Stephen Penrose, and Douglas Martin. These are the corporate first presidency of the LDS Church. In the Sunstone Symposium this last spring or summer, Timmy Hsu raised an interesting question that we don't have an understanding of who's really running the church. We don't know the names of those people. We do have some names. They're right here. Robert Cantwell is the CFO right now of the entire church corporation. And before that position, he was the financial auditor of the whole church. So he went from auditing the church to now and understanding all the ins and outs of how you could embezzle or not embezzle, to now running the money of the church. I am not saying anything that's nefarious. That's not uncommon. It does happen. Auditors usually make a transition to becoming a CFO, usually at a different company, not within, but it's not. But with so much financial opaqueness, that kind of transition does look a little suspicious sometimes. Now, he is not living large. He is not. We've looked up some of his house records. He's not wealthy. He's pretty standard. In fact, he might even be below substandard for a CFO. So I am not claiming anything nefarious, but I just find it interesting. So who are these men really that have access to the 60 billion plus sets of assets and the 10 plus billion income between tithing and investments and commercial business income? Who are these people that run this? There's Tom Kimball at Signature Books has indicated that they have contracted with D. Michael Quinn to write and finish his last tome of the Hierarchy series. And I have it on good authority from him that will be coming out here soon. And he's asked if I would consider reviewing it for him, and I'm considering it. But I want to say that I'm excited to see that Quinn's book is coming out. It will cover from 1830 to 2010, is what I understand. And it will have 80% of it will be footnotes, like his typical style. Very, very thorough, and it takes you years to go through one of those books. But I'm looking forward for that. So look forward to that. That is going to be quite a killer book, I have a feeling. Okay, so just talk about the leader's wealth. When you have unchecked access to large amounts of funds and control over a large corporation or a large entity, a large organization that no one monitors outside of your inner circle, that begins the cycle of corruption. The next stage is that you increase your distance between yourself and those that pay into your bank accounts. And by increasing that distance, you can maintain a lot more control. And then is the next step of the corruption. At that point, you start to feel elite, I would imagine. I mean, just think about the church having this entire square of property that's expanding in Salt Lake, and underneath they have all these tunnels, which I like to call, I know people use the term Morador for something else, but I like to call that the Morador that's underneath the Temple Square. In my book, that's what I refer to it as. the Morador creates this distance between them and the rest of the membership in a way that shows evidence of the cycle of corruption moving on. The next step I've seen is these claims of infallibility. How dare you challenge me? You go to your temple, recommend interview, and you're told or asked if you uphold and sustain the leaders. You're asked if you affiliate or are sympathetic to any apostate groups. And then when you're in the temple, you make a covenant not to speak ill of the leaders. This is another cycle, another step in the cycle of corruption. And it's increasing, and people are becoming fed up. The wealth of the church was not a big deal for a long time because they were in debt for so many decades. It's changed. I have it from someone I trust who has connections to Hurton McConkie and other people who has told me that that there is strong word going around that the church has about $15 billion in liquid cash, not tied up in assets or interest-bearing accounts or anything that they have at their disposal. I'll get into that a little bit later. Pay lay clergy. So, do these guys get a lot of pay? Well, maybe, maybe not, but here's some interesting statements. Hinckley long ago made the statement on the GA pay. He says, the living allowances given to general authorities, which are very modest in comparison with executive compensation in industry, and the professions come from this and the professions come from this business income and not from the tithing of the people. Okay, modest to a CEO compensation tied to business income. These are interesting statements. Business income increases by having good investments in all kinds of areas, by cutting costs, by getting free janitors, free clerks, free property managers, free human resources, free auditors, et cetera, and by selling a product for free with 80,000 missionary sales force that pay for their own way and flooding the internet with free consumers who advertise your product for you for free and having a large political base that includes 7% of the members of the Congress. When you only hold about 1.5% of the population. Do the apostles have jobs? You bet. Their income is probably, as Hinckley said, tied to the business income, which means their job is to cut costs, to grow revenue, to increase better investments, and get better return, not only for the church, but for themselves. Thomas Monson, up until late 2012, was listed with having had three jobs on the corporationwiki.com. Chairman of the LDS Business College, director of BYU Idaho, and chairman of the Corporation of the President, which is his corporate sole position. He has three positions, each of which draws an income that is modest compared to the $20 million a company of the size of the LDS Church, something that would have a net income that's equivalent to a Target Corporation. He draws an income that's modest compared, but he has three jobs. So add that up. Or he has had three jobs. Who knows what he's doing now? Holland, director of Farmland Reserve, and may have other positions within universities that we don't know in terms of board of trustees and things that are lower positions, but his highest position, he basically runs farmland. Uchtdorf is the treasurer under Monson. He handles the money, their homes. Some of you have seen this stuff. Monson, I'm just going to rip through this, though. You can get this data online and on my blog and on a lot of other places. Monson holds three properties worth a little over $1 million. He also is reported, and it's pretty much confirmed, to live in a condominium supplied by the church that is worth $600,000. It's not listed under his name, but that's where he spends his time, despite the fact that he has three properties. And his property taxes are sent to the church, according to, at least for some of the properties, according to the assessor page. Holland has property worth about $1.2 million. We do not know whether he has a gateway condo or not, but probably. A lot of them are listed under ownership of the church, but we don't know where they live. Uchtdorf owns two homes. One of them, these homes in Midway or Heber are basically resort community homes, by the way, in gated communities. For example, the Red Ledges, Uchtdorf owns is a gated community of upper crust millionaires. And this property was listed under Ivory, which was all in partnership with the church, and then transferred to his name shortly after becoming an apostle. Poyd Catpacker, almost $2 million in property. A lot of money for people who were religious teachers or a Deseret Book marketing officers, Monson, or educators, Holland. And now they own a lot of property and may own property in other states that we're still looking into. An interesting one. I don't know if you can read this. I'll try to go through it. This is a Salt Lake County assessor image grab of a gateway condo under Barbara Ballard's trust. And at one point, the deed was owned by Property Reserve Incorporated. That's the church's company. And then it was passed to Barbara Ballard. We don't know for how much, but what we do find is that if you go through the recorder's office and you get file for documents, you can get this one that shows that going from Property Reserve to Ballard a month later, she then took out equity on the asset and handed it over to six organizations, which are all basically owned by her children or her children's spouses. So the property was then sent to the children. Well, this is not uncommon, we're finding, because if you look at the top there, there's the six. If you look at the top there, the entire Gateway condo complex at one point in time was in the name of, how do you say her name? Marjorie Hinckley? It was owned by Marjorie. Now, you know Hinckley was a church employee all his life. But they owned at one point this big condo investment speculation that turned out to be quite lucrative because the church bought all the property and paid a fortune for it. Now, many of you may know that Joseph Smith was very involved in land speculation and usually had Emma purchase them, and it went under her name. There's a trend here. Okay. Likewise, we have under the recorder, we also find something similar to Down Oaks. Property Reserve owns it, and then it goes to Down Oaks. We don't know what happened there for sure, but it looks suspicious. Now, a little tidbit of a couple things that I've learned that you probably never heard before. We talked about the membership information system. There's also a thing called the financial information system. And they do, they keep your records when you're a member that your bishop gets. But they also do, I know this from someone who works in the church office building, and I've confirmed it with other people who have worked there. They do internal candidate investigations for people who are going to be called to be mission presidents or higher. And they keep a system, a dossier system, that's internal to the church offices, like the membership information system, but with more information. And they get as much information as they can on those people from a variety of background checks, their church leaders and all kinds of things, and before they call them to higher positions. These background checks basically vet them for positions so that they don't get egg on their face, or so they can determine how and in what way they can trust this person with information. And of course, everyone signs non-disclosure agreements once they are hired by the church or brought in full-time. The other thing that's interesting is that once they really got beyond deficit spending a few decades ago and started getting into revenue making and holding reserves and saving, and then investing that in things like the City Creek Center, it led to them expanding their software system in the financial departments. One of the systems keeps track of all of the subcontractors. One of the subcontractors has told us that he never got paid for his HVAC, his AC work at the City Creek Mall, and they told him, according to him, just take it out of tithing. Anyway, because he's under non-disclosure agreement, I guess he probably can't talk more about it. I don't know. Around the end, around a few years ago, the Quorum of the Twelve asked the financial department, the software people, to build another information system to keep track of their subcontractors. And then a couple years after that, they asked a very special part of that team to do a separate system that this is the way I understand it, what would be called a leadership information system, which keeps track of contracts that are handed to family of the Quorum, the 12 or others they're associated with, and that they would have access to, but very few other people would. Now, this is rumor and speculation, and it's information I have, and I can't prove any of it. So it could be made up, but it makes sense that they would generate very complex systems to manage these billions of dollars, and it makes sense that if there are a lot of contracts going out to people and they want to prioritize who gets what, they're gonna be tiering the information in some form or another. Okay. This is absolutely speculative, but I'm going to go through it anyway because it's fun. So when the church gets excess donations, they do invest it. That's true. We know this. They take these reserves. They invest it in interest-bearing accounts or other things that can be drawn upon that are not held up. And as they build interest, as the tithing builds interest, they take that money off the top, and then they use it to purchase other assets and other companies that make a profit. Now, once that money goes to those ventures, they're not non-profit anymore. They're for-profit. They, out of that, apparently, and this is speculation, that's where the GA salaries come from. Some of them may come from non-profit organizations when they head up the educational institutions and some of these other organizations and that are charities. Anyway, the speculation is that in order to avoid high tax rates, they can set up charity foundations and donate from these for-profit companies back into these charities, which send the money to a variety of places, including, we know that some of that money ended up with the More Good Foundation. I have that on my blogspot, who then sent money to FAIR, and these are through the LDS charities. But some of the money will go into the big pool that will be considered fodder for interest-bearing accounts, and the cycle begins again. Again, this is speculative, but it's based on information I've gotten from a variety of places and kind of piecing together. Top that off with the 80,000 full-time sales force, the millions flooding social media, the large political base and the majority pressure on the Utah government, and you have a pretty nicely tight running engine, and no wonder they have $15 billion in liquid assets on top of the $60 billion in real assets and properties and companies. It is a Fortune 200-something company. After all that information, people in the church who are faithful shrug at that and say, "I don't. That doesn't matter to me. None of that really can affect my testimony." Financial reasons just don't, because they trust the 12. And why do they trust the 12? Because they're told to and they make covenants to. And why are they doing that? Because they trust the 12. It's very cycle. But at some point, every one of us have a cataclysmic event in our life or something that rocks that shelf. And we end up with a little crack about how we view our leaders. It may be a bishop, and then we see a stake president or somebody up higher up doing something similar, and that crack widens. And eventually we start to question them. And what do we question then? We look at the doctrine and the history. We don't look at the finances. We look at the doctrine and the history. And that's why people leave. John DeLynn did a survey a couple years ago among a lot of doubters and ex-Mormons, over 3,000 self-identified doubters, ex-Mormons, and found out who's leaving and who's doubting. Education-wise, they're across the board very educated, 10% PhDs and a majority with master's or bachelor's degrees, and very few without some college. Income-wise, though, they're more evenly distributed. They're not all rich, and they're not all poor. They're pretty much kind of across the board everywhere. And there are a lot of them were leaders in various capacities, from young women's presidencies and missionaries and elders, quorum presidents, and bishops. And about 42% were women and 58% were men. It's interesting that there probably is a higher representation of men leaving the church, and I don't know why that is, but I could be wrong. I wish I were wrong. What are the reasons for leaving? And these were the self-identified reasons for leaving. I won't even go down the list entirely, but I'm just going to show that that's the list and it's how it ranks. But you can see those lists look like priorities that most of us have. And then shortly after that, the church released the essays. They you know, the whole Marlon Jensen talk about people leaving the church, unlike any other period since Nauvoo. the survey that Dillon did and other things that happened during the Romney campaign suggested to the church that there's a problem here. They released these essays. We knew they were coming. We had heard this through contacts in church offices. We knew Grant Palmer had gotten the same word. We had heard there were going to be about 10 to 12. These are the 10 articles that did come out. Now, how do they overlap with the reasons for people leaving? They line up pretty well right at the top for why people leave. These new essays they chose to put and add to their list line up with the ways that people leave now. Or, if not that, then with the things that the media talks about, like the Mountain Meadow Massacre. So I'm going to go through the essays in quick form. I'm going to take off my coat because I'm hot, so I apologize. Someone turn off that heater. The polygamy essay, I'm taking them in an order that's not necessarily how they were presented. The polygamy essay on the left are the claims the church made. They talk about that the polygamy was instituted among the members in the early 1840s. Well, that's technically possibly true, but they don't mention polyandry and they don't mention Joseph Smith practiced polygamy in the 1830s. It was introduced among the members. That's technically true, but it doesn't refer to the truth that Joseph Smith was already practicing it. They admitted, because D. Michael Quinn basically pounded them over the head with it, that there were polygamous relationships that were continuing to be solemnized after the manifesto. They admitted even some of these happened in the United States, but in the official declaration, Woodruff did lie. It's very clear that they are not, that they were. He said that they were not teaching this war, permitting any person to enter into it. The essay did not go back and say Woodruff was wrong. They didn't admit that. They just said it happened, but they never mentioned Woodruff. So it's a sin of omission. Interestingly enough, they talk about women being free to choose their spouses. Really? Really? That's a bold-faced lie. We know Helen Mar Kimball did not choose Joseph Smith at 37 when she was 14. He coerced her. It will ensure your eternal salvation and your exaltation and that of your father's household and all of your kindred. A 14-year-old girl being pressured by that kind of threat, if I want to call it a threat, even though it probably isn't, is pretty awful. The essay, the omissions, the outright lies, and the technically subtle, crafty statements trashes the history department's reputation in my mind. They really laid out their own agenda in a sense that, yeah, we're going to tell what we have to, but we're going to be crafty about it, and we're not going to give all the information. They know this stuff. These guys are not dumb. They know this stuff better than I do, and most of us at Mormon think no, I'm sure. And yet they chose to be very careful in how they did things. Maybe they were beholden to the brethren, but whatever, their reputation is trashed. They don't bring up the child brides, even though they just discussed the polygamy in Utah families. They still refuse to talk about Brigham Young's marriage to a 16-year-old Lucy Bigelow to Wilford Woodruff's marriage to Emmett Smoot when he was 46 and she was 15, or Lorenzo being 57 and marrying Sarah Efermina at 15, or Joseph F. Smith marrying a 17-year-old. They didn't bring that up. Well, that's not good for the church, obviously, but if they're going to be honest brokers, they kind of bring that stuff up. If they're going to sequester it to just Utah polygamy, they should have still admitted at least some of this. They didn't. Book of Abraham essay, many people's favorite. They embraced the Book of Abraham as scripture. Thank you. That's a great statement. They still hold it as scripture, and it's going to haunt them. We're going to hold them to it. It's not going to be dismissed as apocrypha anytime soon, apparently. They say it's futile to assess his ability to translate papyri when we don't have it all. Really? The studies have shown very clearly, and measurements, mathematical measurements, looking at the spiraling and winding of papyri and all of the different things have shown that there just is no room for the papyrus, on the papyrus for anything except for this, the breathing text, which has nothing to do with the Book of Abraham. So yes, we can assess his translation abilities, plus we have the facsimiles. Where we can assess that? And everybody knows that. You can just look at the facsimiles and he got it wrong. None of the characters Mormon and non-Mormon Egyptologists agree that the characters in the fragment do not match his translation. So they admit that it doesn't, but they do say, the veracity and value of the Book of Abraham cannot be settled by scholarly debate. The book's status as scripture lies in the eternal truths it teaches. Okay, if it's an outright lie and it's made up, then how can God use it to preach truth? Do they not understand that a foundation on sand? Wait, what was that primary song? Yeah, okay. They just don't even remember their primary lessons, apparently. Okay. Well, this just trashes Joseph Smith's credibility as a translator. He couldn't translate regular Egyptian. How the heck can we ever believe he could translate something called Reformed Egyptian on gold plates? He couldn't do either, and he didn't do either. The Book of Mormon is now absolutely in just as much question because of their admissions. And they don't say that, but it's clear to us. All right. One thing he got right on in the Book of Abraham, his God is a phallic God. I don't know if many of you know this, but the God Men on the second facsimile is the fertility God. He has an erection. Can I say that? Oops. You have to cut that. Okay. Anyway, but that's Joseph's God. Another favorite of doubting members, not necessarily ex-Mormons, but doubting members, was the Race and Priesthood essay. No evidence that any black man or any black men were denied the priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime. Well, that they're trying to buoy up Joseph Smith as not being a racist. However, if you look at the Book of Abraham, the Book of Moses, the Book of Mormon, they have scriptures out the wazoo talking about dark skin and curses and the separation of people from their tribe, and the whole tribe of Israel and Abraham is really kind of a racist doctrine in and of itself, because it's saying this family is blessed by God and the rest of you aren't. Well, that's racist, not even a skin color racism. So Joseph Smith was a racist. They can say, oh, well, there's no evidence he was a racist and that he denied the priesthood. Well, but I can just look at his scripture. And it's clear he is. They tried to make a claim that they want to make salvation available to all. Yeah. Tell that to the gays. Tell that to the women who want the priesthood. They're not making it available to all. They're still a male patriarchal order that is basically white. Okay. And this is the one that got the most press. They disavow the theories about how black skin was a sign of curse, and they condemn all racism, unequivocally condemn all racism past, present, in any form. They just threw all the prophets, they segregated them to the back of the bus and then threw them off of the bus. That's what they did. They denied their own canonized scripture, which teaches these things still in the Book of Mormon. This trashes all the prophets. We just trashed Joseph Smith and his translation ability. Now we're trashing the rest of the prophets, up at least through Kimball. A week ago, Ballard gets up and says, "We will not and cannot lead you astray." I know. I couldn't believe it when I heard that. Unless we're talking about race, gender, gender equality, archaeology, Egyptology, astronomy, Masonicals, polygamy, evolution, manifesto. I can go on. And unless we're talking about not leading astray, we don't really mean that either. Stay in the boat. This guy really loves his prophets. I couldn't figure out who this guy is right here, but I think it might be himself. Book of Mormon translation essay talks about the seer stone in the hat, the block out extraneous light. There's a lot of flaws in logic here. I can't get into them all, but here's the fun thing. If the plates were unneeded, then why all the years for waiting? Why all the digging? Why? And so forth and so on. And also, Vogel talks about finding evidence that it was a white hat. Well, how did he block out all the light with a white top hat? I don't know. He had a snug face in his hat. His voice must have been muffled. There's a lot of things that you could pull out of this and think about, but I'm not going to get into them all. Okay. He pressed his face in the hat. English words appeared. This is important. English words appeared on the instrument. I remember him in other documents, not in the essay, where they talk about him spelling the names out. Joseph Smith did not interpret Reformed Egyptian He didn't see things in a vision. English words appeared. This is important. God was the source of these words, according to them, including the racism, the anachronistic errors, the Deutero and Trito Isaiah editions, the King James Version Bible error inclusions, and so forth ad nauseum. God included those things. And Joseph Smith just read it off. It excuses Joseph Smith. He still calls it in their essay the most correct of any book, and they still refer to that statement. The most correct book that needed 4,000 edits, contains racism, anachronistic, it's chloroforming print, and God is a horrible writer, apparently. This trashes God as a racist and a horrible writer. They just trashed their own God, really. So if he didn't need the plates, this comes from Mormon infographics, Bart Pascal. If he didn't need the plates, then why did Nephi murder Laban for the plates? If Joseph Smith didn't really need the gold plates, then why did Nephi need some plates? I don't know. The disconnect and the cognitive dissonance is just rising here. All right. Last essay I'm going to talk about. The Book of Mormon, the DNA in the Book of Mormon. Native Americans carry largely Asian DNA. They admitted it. They also talk about the Lamanites as being among the ancestors of the American Indians. This affirms the Americas were heavily populated well before supposedly Adam and Eve were around. It's 10,000 to 30,000 years ago. Nothing is known about the DNA that Lehi, Sarai, or Ishmael has, so how can we compare it, they say? Well, the non-existent DNA that you claim did exist is hard to match. Well, what about Mulek? He founded the largest city, Zarahemla, and it is very clear from their own book that he allegedly is Jewish royalty as the son of King Zedekiah. That DNA is well studied, and there is no reason for them not to have something to match to. That's bullshit. Oh, BS, sorry. Their position is that secular evidence cannot prove or disprove the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Well, what is agreed is that there were migrations long ago before the supposed Adam and Eve, before the flood, before the Tower of Babel, which are all reaffirmed in LDS scripture as literal, not allegorical. What are they saying now, though? Is it now allegorical? There was no Adam and Eve? Well, if there was no Adam and Eve, then what else goes away? If there was no fall, as in all men, as in Adam, all men die, as in, come on, quote the scripture. As in Christ, all are saved, right? That trashes the need for Jesus Christ. If there was no literal fall, and there was no real Adam and Eve, and they're being allegorical, and sin just evolved, like scientists say, if you want to call it sin, then how is that being our responsibility and not God's, who created the whole process? They just trashed the need for Jesus Christ, the atonement, by basically saying the Lamanites mixed with older people, with people older than Adam. There was no Adam, there was no fall, and apparently no atonement. My little razor here. Facts advanced allegorically can be discarded readily. Or you can say what is spiritually introduced can be sharply reduced. Because they are moving from literal statements to now saying, well, he translated, it wasn't really on paper. The DNA is just a spiritual thing. They're really just spirits. A spiritual DNA, they're adopted into the house of Israel spiritually. I don't know, whatever their answers are. Whatever's introduced that way can just be reduced when they try to make these claims. Okay, I'm going to move on. I know, I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to finish up. The essays failed. They demolished the history department, Joseph Smith, the other prophets, their God, and their need for Jesus' atonement. Their inoculation on members, well, I have been told there by an IT person who worked at church offices that when they were putting the essays up, they asked them specifically to create the search engine in such a way that those essays wouldn't be found under benign searches. Only if people were searching with very specific keywords would those essays come up on the list. The church doesn't want people to actually find them unless those people already appear to have been infected with the ex-Mormon virus. So are they inoculated? It doesn't look like it. You know what happened to the IT guy that was upping the essays as he was reading them? He lost his testimony. So, what are the next moves? Well, there's a history museum coming, an expansion of the history museum. They're going to include first visions. They're basically taking some of the essays and creating displays and history behind them now. So maybe they are going to put this out to the public. That'll be interesting to see if it's really going to happen. KSL is the one who announced that a couple weeks ago. There's evidence to suggest they're going to change their strategy from trying to control information to trying to keep people from asking wrong questions and telling them how to properly ask questions so that they don't have to control the information, they just have to get control of the people asking the questions. There's the Meet the Mormons full-length movie. It's a hard sell, register, trademark process. Was this an attempt to try to create some public view of how Mormons should be seen before Romney might announce that he's going to run in 2016? I don't know. There was a call for popular media, video games, and apps to software developers. It's in the Deseret News in August. There's a lot of things they're trying to do still that are more popular than doctrinal. They're really moving on the popular, flood to social media, make games, let's do full-length movies, let's create cutesy art displays in our museum. None of this stuff is really going to address the core problem of information anymore. They're moving away from that, it looks like to me. What are our next moves? Well, I'm going to slide through this pretty fast, but I don't know what the right approach is, but there's a lot of people taking a lot of approaches, and all of them are good. I want to discuss the idea of how we can approach people in general. The saying at the bottom, I like this: if you want to grow prosperity, grow grain. 10 years of prosperity, trees. 100 years, grow people.
We should also strengthen our children by encouraging them to define themselves by their growing testimonies, not just by their recognitions in scholarship, sports, or other school activities.
This is insidious. Every one of us in here have felt the effects of this because we are struggling to get over our foundations. And the reason why was because the LDS Church grabbed us at such a young age and told us to define ourselves by what they say and what they tell us we are, that when we learned that we can't trust them or we don't believe in their system, that embedding influence in a young person it takes years to peel away and may never happen because some of those things might not be hardwired. This is insidious. Shame on you, Dallin Oaks, who was a lawyer and a judge and knew the art of manipulation and how it is discouraged in courts and even by judges, supposed to be stopped when a lawyer or a witness is using manipulative tactics. They're taught and trained in how to recognize these things. And here he is teaching people to still do it. Shame on him. So how do we help people? How do we help ourselves overcome the brainwashing? I'm going to move through this a little quickly, and I want to talk about my take on LDS personality types. This is a very simplistic model, but it's useful to use models so that we can kind of grasp how we might approach things. I see that this in social science, there's the four quadrant kind of approach just for understanding people that you interact with at work or in organizations, and I kind of took this and turned it into an LDS version. We have the analytical group, the doctrinal Druze, who are very much philosophical based. We have the Logan leaders, who are drivers. Both of those two are task-oriented. They are about tasks, not people. One of them is more about obedience, and one of them is more about proclaiming. And then you go down to the other side, you've got the Sammy sheep, who are really about helping people and obeying. And you've got the Jesse jet-setters, who are about the social interaction at church. They love people, and they like being out there and talking. Now, not everybody is only in one category. You slide around, and at different times of your life, you might find yourself in the opposite quadrant. We move around, and it's very fluid. But you can recognize these different people, I'm sure, and members that you know. A little story, quick story to kind of exemplify these different people. These four members types were going into the cultural hall, and they go start getting ready for a function, and they come in, and there's a big pile of horse manure in the middle of the floor. Well, the leaders start barking orders and telling everybody what to do. The sheep are ready to act, and the doctrinal masters are there with the tools. They've got the shovels, they got the bags for disposal and the wipes and the cleaning. And the Jesse jet sitters see the horse maneuver and say, "There must be a pony somewhere." So that kind of exemplifies the different people. And a lot of people who are jet sitters tend to already kind of work their way out of the church because they're so social, they like to hang out with fun people. Okay. Really quickly, leaders, what do they fear? What do people fear in the church losing if they leave the church? They fear losing control and power, the esteem of others. They're movers and shakers. And while it is the camel at the front of the caravan that holds up everything, it is the ones at the back, the sheep, that get the beating. The sheep fear losing peace and tranquility and connections. Their followers, they need that security of knowing that they're being directed properly and the feeling peace that the world is in order. The doctrinal masters fear losing philosophical correctness. They want to be truth and accurate, and they want to teach it. The Jesse jet setters fear losing fun, being bored. So let's throw them a party. Let's invite them tonight. What is the overlap? Esteem of others. Every one of these people want the esteem of others, but for different reasons. How can we use this overlap in common? You got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Maybe sometimes it can be like a nail. Common approach. Well, everybody has this victim mentality, and they're susceptible to the opinion of other people, especially their non-member friends who they're supposed to be performing missionary work on. This is interesting because they're very susceptible to what their non-Mormon friends think. An ex-Mormon can tell them all kinds of things, and they're just going to plug their ears. But a non-Mormon friend who might be a golden investigator saying those same things will make them listen because they'd want their esteem for some reason because it's a missionary opportunity, and if they get that working, they'll get the esteem of people that they esteem in the church. So, popular media is a great influence for this reason. We know the Book of Mormon Broadway musical. We know Big Love, Sister Wives. We know Crockett's book and other things written by non-members and specials on PBS, BBC have been quite influential on people, including members. When they see these things, it creates fear in them, and they have to find answers to combat it for their non-member friends. What these writers are doing is they're entertaining. They're very entertaining. They're fun, they're popular, and first of all, they are about keeping your attention. So we need to think about how to keep people's attention. Mormon craziness fascinates people. It's crazy. Maria is a non-member who is just absolutely fascinated by what Mormons do as a subculture, the ex-Mormons do even. So we need more fun, we need more artists, we need more parties. In my own attempt, I do write the blog, but I also wrote a novel last year called The Second Anointing. It's a psychological thriller. It shows the dramatic effect how that ordinance has on a rising authority in the church who turns a secret day and night by vision. And then, as he's going through that, slowly learns that the brethren lie and that there are doctrinal issues, and how he then approaches that is the culminating. The sequel to that, called Next I Am, in the middle of right now, is a suspense thriller. It talks about a dissolving LDS church as it dissolves, how it disperses its wealth according to these articles of corporation as well as other laws, and how that brings about a secular movement that could transform society. But the powers that be don't want it. This is a peek of how Joseph Smith's little experiment that grew into a massive religion could end up having a vast effect on society if its wealth and its craziness were to be used in a positive way among secular groups. Imagine this. If you took the $8 billion to $10 billion of tithing and business income the church brings in, and you were to put that all into research that, like cancer research or other research that the NIH does, their budget is smaller. Imagine if all of that went into just for a few years in cancer research and did it in a way that they didn't depend upon the government or other organizations to mandate their agenda. And there would be no influence from big corporations either. Imagine we could solve cancer, we could cure cancer with that kind of budget. And I'm not making that up as a molecular biologist. I believe it's true. We could. There could be huge effects upon the world if the wealth of religion were turned to good use. And it could be done in ways that weren't influenced by big corp or big gov. So, now, this is a parting thought. I'm sure most of you get asked this question. Why do you keep venting against the church? Can't you just leave it alone? In fact, you're fulfilling prophecy, you kicking against the pricks. Yeah, they are. Fulfills prophecy, your anger isn't helping anyone. Well, they're upset. But I have to tell you, it would be irrational of a person not to be angry about being defrauded this much. A financial con that takes in six figures of your income, I don't know how much many of you, but I had, with my ex-wife and family, donated six figures of income to the church, as well as thousands and thousands of hours in missionary work and in callings. When all told, and I were to tally up the equivalent cost, it's at least $250,000 to $750,000. It's not a hard prophecy to make that if you know you're conning people, they're going to be awfully angry at you and wanting retribution and want their money back and want their time back and their life back. It's not a hard prophecy to make. And I'm sure that Madoff could have made the same prophecy. Don't be ashamed that it angers you. That's rational. When people tell you stop the anger, they're being irrational. I'm not saying that we should act angrily towards people, but those feelings are legitimate. And this is the summary. I'll just quickly say the essays were a failure, and we are making headway in disclosing documents, and we are trying to hold the church to the ground on some of these, and we hope to help more members find the truth. That's it. Any questions? I guess, okay, you got someone standing there. Sure.
I was just really surprised by the mission president side of it, because as a missionary, I remember trusting my mission president as being somebody that was very, I guess, pure in heart and out there for the right reasons and sort of successful in some way, and that's why they were able to kind of sacrifice to be there. But then I felt like it was almost like career move, and the way I see missionaries is, of course, salespeople now selling an $80,000 product, tithing, you know, over the course of one's life. And so now I see mission presidents, and I just wonder, you said that there were differences between the mission president's pay, possibly. I wonder if they're getting sort of commissions on baptisms or something like that, or what do you think?
I have no idea, but that's an interesting thought. Boy, that would be pretty scandalous if it came out. And I imagine that some mission president would be pretty angry that they got sent to France when another one got sent to Africa or wherever there's high. So I don't know. I don't know about
how many
that.
Mission presidents leave? Like, do we know any?
Yeah, there's a few that have left the church.
We could ask them.
Yeah, we could. Okay. We could ask. Yeah, there's a couple. We can probably approach them. Are you Chris Williams?
Chris Johnson.
Johnson. That's right. I'm sorry, I got the last name. You gave a talk last year, right?
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Thank you.
That was a really good talk. Thank you for that. Your hard work.
All of us that were in the church were told repeatedly that the 12 apostles and the three are prophets, seers, and revelators. That we sustain them twice a year at least. in doing so, with the revelation that the partial part of the papyrus has been found, has there been any call to request that Thomas S. Monson himself then retranslate to verify that the papyrus is the actual documented papyrus and that the information is actually the Book of Abraham?
Can I say that that is a great idea, not because it would expose them. It would just be a lot of fun to watch Monson in his mental state currently and the story he would come up with. Pass. I wanted to also say I've got some videos from Mormon Think. I could hand out top 10 Mormon problems if any of you have seen it or want a copy. I've got a few. That's all.
The 2014 amendment that you mentioned to the Articles of Incorporation.
Yes.
Where Monson gave those three.
Yes.
Is that jointly or severally? Can they do it? Do they have that authority? Is it as a quorum or individually, or do you know?
They all were listed together, and the authorizations that were given them were listed together in that document. But there are other documents that give Cantwell additional authorities that the other two didn't have as CFO.
So
you can look at the documents on the Blogspot and read it.
So from a legal perspective, any one of them have the same authority as Monson?
No. They authorized them with certain parts of his authority. I don't know all of the attributes or authorities or responsibilities that Monson has, to tell you the truth. So I would have to have a financial expert or a business corporate expert tell us how many things line up and don't. I don't know. I'm not that guy.
And back to a point of speculation, I would appreciate you speculating. Who's really running the church right now?
I think it's such a big corporation that it's not necessarily being run by any group or even, especially person or even group of people who know everything about it. But I do think that, like any big corporation, the major decisions are made by a few, and they basically understand the overall picture, and the minutiae and details down the chain go just like any other corporation down to junior officers and to staff. But the real question is, what are they doing with the profit? That's my question. Are they reinvesting it? Who are they paying, and what are they paying them? Why can't they, like almost all other churches, at least in America, and especially outside of America, provide some documentation and maintain or and create financial transparency? Why do they need non-disclosure agreements if they're not hiding anything? Why do they need these people to run this if they have a prophet that supposedly is God's mouthpiece? You know. Okay.
Yeah, great presentation.
Thank you.
I work in marketing, high-tech marketing, and I one time sold software to the church, and it was back in the 90s, and it was a small startup company in Orem, and we went to, I guess the director of our PR group used to work for Edelman Worldwide, and one of her professors was Bruce Olson, a director of public affairs at the church, LDS Church. And so we went up to the Joseph Smith Memorial Building and called on him, and it was just before Hinckley was going to be on 60 Minutes. And I was really impressed with the depth and breadth of professionalism in the church's PR department. And I've watched, you know, them embrace social media. I mean, that's kind of what I do, is I focus on social media strategies for my company. And very, very sophisticated. And I personally know a senior vice president of Edelman Worldwide. He's a personal friend of mine. And she says there's a dedicated team, Edelman, that supports the LDS Church's PR. And she said they have one of the most professional public relations departments of any that rivals any corporation in the world. You know, they've trotted out this movie, you know, Meet the Mormons, mm-hmm. Mitt's moving to Utah, probably going to give another run for the White House, you know. I'm just curious, what are your thoughts about PR and how it's driving the... And I would submit that public relations is really driving the church, and that's they're the ones calling the shots. But I'm just curious what you thought about that.
they certainly have a vast effect on how the world and the members themselves see the church, and that then brings back money or not. And they certainly have a lot of effect. I don't know that they necessarily are running the church, but they certainly are an important arm of it, I've got to believe. But I think there's a financial arm, and there's a real estate arm. There's an investment, Enzyme Peaks, there's Kurt and McConkie that are contract organizations that help run things. It's vast. For a Fortune something, 200-something company, of course, who has a free sales force for the most part, they have a large budget available to them for PR that they can use that will efficiently use the sales force. And they're going to have a large budget. They have a lot of money, and why not advertise? Any corporation would.
With all of the changes with the states that are legalizing gay marriage, I think it's only a few years away before plural marriage or multiple marriages is going to happen. How is the church going to get ahead of that to redefine if polygamy was done away with because it was against the law of the land, mm-hmm. and it's no longer against the law of the land, how are they going to keep from having the bishop run after her little kids to marry them?
That's a really good question. If you look at OD1, Official Declaration 1 with Wilford Woodruff, he does not talk about God said or this is a revelation. What he does is wave a white flag of we give up. It wasn't really the revelation in a sense if we think of it. And the fact that they gave up and it wasn't, hey, the Lord said stop because it's no longer doctrinally effective. That's where you got all these splint-off groups that were created. So to your point, it is a problem for them because it's just like the race and the priesthood in that they can't really come up for the reason why it was disbanded. And now how are they going to get around it when it is legal again? It's a problem. I don't know how it's going to happen. Do you want to end here? You were raising your hand. We got to quit.
Okay. Just wondering about the any follow-up to the 13 essays, if they're going to have any more. You know.
We were told that there would be multiple tiers, and now it looks like they're moving a different direction. I think it's because they're admitting internally it was a failure.